So we're recording our conversation today, and it looks like we're going to be focusing on how to make this kind of inspiring and meaningful work into a business, how to actually secure clients and to make it a source of valid and substantial income so that we can continue and be sustainable in doing the work we love. So, So Deborah, you're at the point of getting certified as, and you're really well on your way as an ES and a TRI, and living in an area where there's really a great need for this sort of thing because nobody else is doing it. And actually I'd be interested in knowing what kinds of people you feel most called to work with, especially just to get started, knowing that it may develop into other areas.
Well, my focus, that what I really want to work with, I have three populations in mind that I want to reach out to, and one is the cancer survivors, one is youth at risk, and one is the veteran population. And I think I can pretty much replicate what Happy Trails does at my place, because they're in Tulare, I'm in Fresno, I live in Madera, so I have two counties that don't have any type of a riding program, but since Happy Trails has had their equine facilitated psychotherapy program, and they got that through a state grant, and if I can find a way to match that grant and convince Fresno and Madera that they need to do something like that, that grant fully funds the program they do in Tulare. So that would be really awesome.
Where is the grant from?
It's a state grant. It's an SB 60 grant that comes from the state to the different counties. So I'm still searching for a grant writer, somebody to help me to look into, find that grant and make a grant, get my grant applications going so I can see if I can pull in some of the funding. Because what they do is Happy Trails does a 12-week-long program, and the county sends out a therapist with the kids, and they run kids anywhere from 5 to 17. The county sends the therapist out, so you get the equine-facilitated psychotherapy, and so it's a really neat program. And I just got to kind of start looking and finding the funding. I got to find a grant writer. I'm having issues finding a grant writer, but, I know nothing about nonprofits, Trish. nothing. I'm walking into, I don't know, and I'm trying to figure it out.
So you are going to, you need to be a nonprofit for this grant?
Yes. And I have a nonprofit. I've already secured my nonprofit. I have my board. I have my nonprofit. So I'm already, that took me 7 months to get, but I have that already in place.
Right. So, and there's a lot of wisdom available. I think I probably talked about that in any community. They have organizations that support nonprofits. They help train board members and just kind of help someone like you who is well-intentioned but needs to have, some learning about how to do it. It sounds like you've been doing that. And it's an ongoing sort of thing. I don't know about your board members, but what I found is that most board members don't really fully understand what their jobs are, and that can be problematic when they start operating outside of what you need for them to do, or they're not essentially doing anything, which is the other thing. That's something to be, that's just an ongoing process, I guess is what I'd say, an ongoing learning that from my experience. And oftentimes, people pull together a board and, it's not really spelled out what you expect of them or what they expect of one another. And so that's something that requires certainly a yearly review as things come up. Mainly, their job is community support, enlisting community support, but that has a lot of different forms. And, yeah, so I don't know about in California.
I'm pretty lucky there. Yeah, I'm pretty lucky there because my CPA is also my treasurer, and he also does work with, I mean, 60% of his business is with nonprofits. He has a large number of contacts in the community that, you know, we're trying to, you know, resource into. And then one of my board members is a veteran's wife. She's worked with nonprofits before, and she's also good at web design and marketing. So I have
that piece
to kind of work from. Mm-hmm. And then one of my other board members has worked with nonprofits before, and she's also a wife of a veteran who has some other community contacts. And then my other board member is, he has done a lot of work with nonprofits, and he also has kind of some background in, he actually, his family ran a therapeutic writing facility when he was a kid. So
he has
a good idea of what I'm doing and what I need to accomplish. And so he's been up getting photographs and, you know, putting together some stuff so that we can get the website moving. And so it's right now I think it's working on contacts and finding my grant writer so that I can, you know, really hone into trying to get some of that funding to start to start coming in that way. But then the other piece that I found is just, you know, like, okay, I've been kind of trying to reach out to people going, you know, send me somebody you think would be interested and let me just start doing the programs. And I've had a hard time actually finding people. And that's been what's just kind of like, I just thought, oh, well, this shouldn't be too bad. It's not going to cost them anything. You know, let's get them out there. And that's been the kind of the hard part. It's surprising.
Yeah. Well, I know what you mean. It feels surprising, but it doesn't surprise me at all from my experience in the past that it's very typical, actually. It'll help when you have a grant that targets a population who's going to come to you from the county, because there'll be a system there that will enable the therapist and the client to just sort of step into something, a system that's set up, you know. But without that, it is a challenge. And what I found is that helps is to make it a sort of a special event that you're doing a pilot program. And, like, you get a team of people, like your board would be the perfect people to do that, to sort of promote that as, you know, you're going to do this special pilot program in whenever, decide when you're going to do it, and get the media behind it, you know, TV, radio, newspaper, that you're, you know, this is a special opportunity for people to be in this pilot program. Now, but the thing is, you're talking about at-risk youth, right? Is that what you said?
Well, they're just one of the populations. I really do want to I want to do something very similar to Riding Beyond. So I do want to find that population, too.
So what you've got to do is decide who you're going to target for your pilot program, okay? And you need to get real targeted, like specific, like this is who you want. I wouldn't say go for all three of these. I would suggest you target it for the purpose of getting things started and getting a sense of momentum going in the community. And if I were you, I'd just pick the one that you think would be easiest. Like maybe the veterans are the ones because you've got two vets' wives on your board, okay? Because all of these people are hard to get them to show up, okay? And especially to get them to continue to come, especially at-risk youth, because they're in broken families generally, and we had families just pick up and move. For instance, a couple of them just unexpectedly, they didn't show up one day and they decided to move out of state. Who knows what was going on in their lives? You know, it's that kind of, you know, they're in unstable families in general. And so you can't ever rely on them showing up unless they're coming from, like, one of the things that we did once we saw that happening for 2 years by working, we were working with the school system initially.
Uh-huh.
And in the second year, what we did was we worked with the Boys and Girls Club because they basically would go and pick the kids up at home in a van and bring them to the program. Even then, we had kids who just weren't there. I mean, because they're from unstable families, but it helped more, okay, to have, you know, someone who was committed to go and get the kids at their homes and bring them to the program, okay? But still, we wanted better attendance than that with those kids. And so we ended up for 7 years working with a residential treatment center because they would bring those kids, you know, because they were right there in their facility. And we could rely on the fact that we would have someone show up. Now, you know, so they'd bring a group of eight girls or eight boys. But even so, sometimes they'd end up coming with six one day. And, you know, two of the kids would run away. Okay? Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of a thing that you're working with people who are just don't show up for things. Now, to say with the veterans, the key to getting veterans to show up is having a veteran helping you with that issue, that they're rounding them up
and
bringing them in. And it sounds like you have some contacts for that. Veterans, I've heard so many programs say that they just don't keep coming. You know, they're not, whatever, for a lot of reasons, they don't keep coming. And, but if there's a colleague, someone like another veteran, that's the key in general to, you know, they know how to talk to them and know how to encourage them to be there and to continue the commitment and to really elicit an initial commitment. And I know the program in Houston, who, you know, this really big program, SIRE, was, you know, they had a whole day set up one time of where they gotten like three van loads of veterans were supposed to come for an all-day event, and none of them showed up. None of them. They were just flabbergasted. They just couldn't believe that nobody would come. And yet, when they looked into it, they realized that they had to reconfigure it, that the vets on their own didn't particularly want to come. They didn't see that it was going to help them. They had other things they wanted to do, whatever. But what they did was they refocused on bringing their families in. There was a family activity for them and their families. And then they came. Then they started coming because they wanted to do things with their families. And so, you know, you've got to kind of work with who you've got, but to know that these are significant issues. For cancer survivors, they tend to feel that they don't want to have anything to do with any kind of therapy anymore. They've had enough of that. They might be interested in, they need to be interested in some kind of revitalization, but they often don't see why horses would be that helpful to them. And they often feel very vulnerable in general about their lives. And so they are in many cases actually afraid of being around horses. They may not admit it that much, but, you know, they're hesitant to step into an activity like that without a lot of encouragement from family and friends. And not to mention the fact that they're just in general often feeling pretty reclusive and antisocial, you know. And so in an effort to cope with the effects of treatment. And so those are all things that are they're important for you to be aware of and to have strategies of enlisting other people. It's got to be a team effort. You can't do it yourself. But you've got to find some strategic people. Like, I mean, you say you've got two veterans' wives on your board. Like, get those veterans. See if their husbands would be willing to help with the pilot program, and that you pilot with veterans, and just really you want to make sure that the media covers it, and that, because people in general need to hear about something from five different sources before they'll sign up for it. Okay, that's just a good, that's a traditional rule of thumb. So they need to hear about it on the radio, an email, you know, a person, a friend calls them up, you know, they see about it, they see it in the newspaper, they see a poster around town, you know, whatever. They need to have that sense of that they're stepping into something that's got some substance and momentum. And the media will get behind it if you let them know about it, because they're always looking for news. And they'll give you that support, you know, and you can rely on them to cover other events when there's a newsy aspect to it. You know, like this is something new that you're doing, then they'll hop on it and be there. And especially something with horses is very appealing to the media. So, yeah.
So is that a good thing to do, to just go big like that before you've really kind of honed in? So, okay, I guess what I go back to in my fear is, okay, I have written out, you know, what I think this should look like and kind of how I would, you know, I initially, mind you, knowing flexibility is key, but, you know, how I kind of have it written out, this is kind of what I'd like to do each week, this way, blah, blah, blah. But having not really had the chance to actually, you know, get somebody in and say, this works, this doesn't work, how should I change this, do you do that first before you just go big, or you just go big and figure it out from there?
Well, frankly, that what I sense? Do is I get a few friends to come out. Maybe I'm going to target veterans, but I don't happen to I don't have any friends who are veterans, so I just have a few friends come out, my buddies.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and I say, I just want to try this out with you. What do you think? And get their feedback on it. You know, and they, you know, they think it's fun. You know, you definitely want to get to a point of comfort where you've tried it out on your friends first. You know, and then you do want to go big when you actually go with a client. Okay, when you
if
it's, because the pilot program's really. It's an important launching point symbolically,
right.
The symbolic power of it. But just for you to, you've got to start building a presence in the community. And they're not gonna be there and checking up on you like, okay, how successful was she? You know, they're not gonna create any problems like that. Okay, that's the only way you're gonna get people to show up. Really, is to go big with the pilot program, okay? And the pilot program is just that. People know that you're testing something out. You're testing out the community support. Is this something that you all want, that people want here, okay? And if you can't get people behind it in the pilot program, well, you need to pay attention to that. Something's not right. I mean, and so that's, but, yeah, the very first step would be to get a few friends to come out, maybe several times, to try different things, you know, get different groups of friends. It just can be, you know, three or four people. It doesn't have to be a bunch of people. And they know that that's what it is, you know. This could be some fun. People at work, whatever.
Okay.
You know, and, you know, for a couple, 2 or 3 hours. Something like that, or even just for an hour, whatever you want to do, whatever you think will work. And so I see that we've got a couple other people joined us. Jen and Pat Walters has joined us. Hello, Pat.
Hi.
Hello, Jen.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. We're talking with Deborah here about the challenges of getting things launched. She's got a lot of pieces in place, not as many as
oh,
Pat
yes.
does, but Deborah, soon, by the end of the year, she's going to be certified as an ES and a TRI, and so she's looking at. But she's got a. She's got
I'm
a
already.
But,
oh. Oh, who me?
Who?
Oh,
Deborah.
I don't know who. Deborah, good Deborah, way to go.
Deborah's got a nonprofit, really strong board, it sounds like, and she's got a great source for funding, which is awesome.
Awesome.
With a grant that Happy Trails has put her on to. And, yeah, so she's got a lot of really important pieces. And
well, hey, so Trish, this is Jen. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, I can. Yeah. I did come in kind of on the end, but what I would like to say about what I've been catching, what I caught of what Deborah had to say was that, you know, that pilot program is really great for the co-creation aspect of what you're doing as well. It's hard to start something all on your own and to have a group of people that are enthusiastic and behind you and you know you're just checking it out. They remained some of our best supporters, the people that were in the pilot program. And it really has given a richness and a depth to Writing Beyond. I work with Trish in Writing Beyond. I don't know, maybe I should introduce that first, but I was there at the pilot program, and I'm sure we had some practice with friends, but it was really about the community getting together and seeing what kind of support we really could all co-create and just allow to fill that space. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So sounds like you've got a lot of great
pieces.
Exciting.
Jen was part of the very first
pilot
trial with friends when I just put climbed up on
that
Mystic's
too.
Back to see if she'd do it. And in fact, I think you were the second person who got on her back. I mean, that was pretty basic.
I think we traded spots. We thought it was so fun we did it again.
Yeah. And so, but, you know, before that, I mean, over the past years, whenever I come up with some new idea, you know, I always test it out on friends first. And it's usually not horsey friends, actually. In that case, it was with Jen. But I get friends that I know in other situations to come out because I want to get that perspective from people who are not horse enthusiasts.
Horse
know,
people, yeah.
Yeah. So, So, Pat, I read your rant here just a few minutes ago, just before we started the call, so I didn't have a chance to
I know.
Respond to it on Facebook.
That's
maybe
okay. I don't know what day it is.
Well, no, it's really important what you were saying. Would you mind summarizing it for the purposes of this call for Deborah and Jen?
Of course, I've never had my own center, so I'm developing it from shoot from the hip and scrambling around and asking as many people and researching and taking classes. Nothing prepares you for starting a center or building a business. Like I wrote in my email, just because you get certified, done all the classes, and good job pat on the back, you build it, they will come, really doesn't work. You build it, and you build it, and you build it. And right now, just getting together new client packets, which you have to give them and have ready for them, legal and just welcoming-wise, which, you know, you don't get a course on that, and you have to, and volunteer packets and go writing a letter of introduction to therapists around town and then dealing with Markel and all the other legal issues and making sure I'm vetting horses that people are going to let me use and getting my center ready. It's work, but it's good work, and it's you want to bang your head against the wall, but it's okay. Put a pillow on the wall. I just needed to rant because I didn't know what day it was. I was so overcome with paperwork. It's amazing, Trish. It is just overwhelming.
Yeah, Pat called in just for your others to understand. She called in, tried to join the call yesterday at 1:00.
I thought it was.
I saw that on the Facebook page. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. I thought that I have an extra day in my week. I could get more paperwork done.
Right. Well.
But I'm trying now how to get. Yeah. How to encourage people to donate to Biggie. I have a GoFundMe, and you know it doesn't. People really just want to pat you on the back and say go for it. But their money needs to go into other things. I understand that, and we don't have a grant, and so just find out how to approach businesses. And I don't have a track record or a trackable account of how this helps or how my center helps people, something measurable to give them how their money works and what it's going for. It's brand new, so, you know, if you have something like that, they go, yes, I could see where it's going, but, you know, when you're brand new, they just look at you and say, well, you know, get in touch with us when you get going and see how it's going. And so it's really, you can write a book on this. This is good.
Well, so Pat, let me just ask you, I hear you saying you're doing all these really important cornerstone pieces to sort of create a good foundation, but I don't hear you talking about other people helping you with this. Do you have a team of people who are working with you on this?
I have one lady who was at our workshop in Zen who really wants to join, and she's hasn't finished her equine specialist yet. She's working up in Forward Stride, who asked me to come up and help them start a program because I have my equine specialist. So I have her, Karen Wakefield, but she's really can't do anything because she's working and she has a child and she goes up there. So I'm really on my own. And down here, I have the university behind me. You know, they're ready to send me volunteers and, you know, students and some of the clients. I just have to, you know, get my paperwork in order, and I'm really on my own for it.
Paddling
a boat upstream.
I want to say that, you know, you've got to change that immediately, Pat.
Okay.
You've got to put the word out to get several somebody, to be helping you. Do you have a board of directors? Are you a nonprofit?
I am. I finally acquired my nonprofit. I have a very tiny board of directors, but I'm now searching to get more professional people on to help me because I have realized I do need that. I do know that. So I put out letters yesterday inviting a welcome letter. I'd like to speak with you about what we're developing here. We will be the only PATH center or any equine center in Lane County that specializes in EAL. So it's good. And these people haven't gotten back to me. So my next thing is, not to be rude, but to go ahead and give them a phone call and say, I'd like to, you know, have an appointment with you and meet with you, take you out to lunch, anything you need, just, you know, for you to come on board. And so I'm at that point now.
Okay, so let me explain to you how I went about several times in enlisting those core people, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because you need to get a group of people and your board of directors, yes, you do need certain skills professionally. I was really impressed with, for instance, Deborah's board. She has a CPA. She has two women who are wives of veterans. She has a woman who's a web designer in marketing. So she's got some real clear skills.
That's good.
They all have experience on a nonprofit board.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need something along those lines where those people are picking up some of these jobs that you're doing. Okay, it's important that you assign them if you have to, because they're just going to continue to say, good job, Pat. You go for it.
Trish, I need to, either get on, you know, find out where they are in town, knock on the door, and start asking them, would they join?
The board members?
I don't know these type of people, so I'm going to have to just go to CPAs and see if I can find, you know, a CPA willing to come on board and just slowly work my way down the list.
Generally, I find that cold calling doesn't work very well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I find it personally just kind of hard to do, but especially when it has poor results. So what you want to do is put out the word to people that you do know, okay? I'm sure that you know somebody who knows somebody who's a CPA, okay? Eventually in your circle of connections, there's going to be someone who can be a potentially good board member. But first, before you start targeting board members, you want to just find out who is in support of the program. Because if you don't have some people showing up at a meeting, then that's something to pay attention to. Like you said, you can get all this stuff together and nobody's going to come, okay?
Right.
And so, you know, what you do, what I've always done, even when I moved here to Ashland, within the first few weeks, I didn't know anybody, okay? I thought when I moved to Ashland that I was going to be working at the Hope Equestrian Center, but it took us 2 years to sell our house in Texas. By the time I got here, the Hope Center had been closed for a year and a half. And,
oh, wow.
And so I was, like, pretty discouraged because I really didn't want to be a director. I just wanted to be a therapeutic writing instructor.
Right, that's what I want, yes.
And so what I did was, you know, I'd been here just a few weeks, and I knew that the Hope Center had been in operation, and so I asked the director, the person who had founded it, to give me a few names of parents who had been there. And I think I called them. I said, you know, do you think the Hope Center is needed in the Valley? And they said yes. And so in your case, you would call, like I would call the schools. And in fact, that's what I did. I called the schools. And I called and talked to their officials who were in special education. Okay, I just called anybody I could think of and said, I'm new here, but I'm wanting to see if there's a need for this program, and because I want to reopen it if there is. And I just had a meeting at my house. I just, you know, I set it like 2 weeks out one evening, and I had like 20 people showed up. Okay. I encouraged, like I said, you know, I'd like to get some medical professionals here, some people from the schools, some parents, you know. So I just went about putting the word out, and so these people showed up, okay? And I did that two more times. I didn't have as many people, but they were different people who came the next time, you know, so that, you know, I ended up with a group of about 40 people, as I recall, I don't know, 30, 40 people who wanted to help. And so, you know, I didn't ask any of them to be on a board. We weren't ready for that, okay? Because, and also, we didn't know one another. How would I know what kind of board member they'd be, okay?
Right.
But, you know, the idea was that we would be forming a board. We started looking at what needed to happen. Well, we needed some money, was one thing, to start things up. And the fact is, there are quite a few people in any community who want to get behind starting something, okay? If they think it's a good idea, if you're real clear about this is something that's good for the community, they're gonna want to. People like to do that. It's like they see it as a one-time gift. You've got to remember that. And they'll give, you know, even when we started writing Beyond, this woman out of the blue, because she saw it on the front page of the newspaper, she gave us $1,000. She didn't know us at all. And I, after a few weeks, I said, I'd like to thank you and have, you know, invite you out to coffee. And I asked her, like, how did you, like, hear about it or anything, you know? that years ago, and she's an elderly person. I'd say she's in her 70s or 80s even, maybe. She said that years ago someone had told her that it was better to give a larger chunk of money for something starting up than to give a smaller amount to a whole bunch of different things, and that she had thought that was a good idea. And so that every year she looked around. And frankly, there are quite a few people like that, okay? And I mean, they aren't necessarily going to give that much money, but, you know, sometimes they give even more. We had another person give $5,000 from a family foundation. And they told us right away that it was a one-time gift. And So there are people like that. The point is that you start getting different people coming to these meetings to help out, and you give them specific jobs to do that need to happen. You gotta stop doing all this stuff yourself. You have to find ways to encourage other people to do really specific things that you need to have done,
mm-hmm.
Because they will continue to offload stuff onto you if you let them, because they see that, you know, you've got the vision, you've got the qualifications. And, I mean, you do it in a polite way. You just say, you know, I don't have time to do that. Who else could do that? People will step forward, or they might know somebody else who could do it. You know, you just start working with whoever shows up. I mean, if you want to do EAL, are you wanting to work with young people or what?
Yes, young people and adults.
Uh-huh. So, you could talk to the schools and pitch them for how you might work with their, you know, the needs that they have in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, find out what the priorities are for the schools, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Like they have certain priorities, and you design your work and talk about it in language that relates to those specific goals. They might even end up funding you. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's that kind of thing where, you know, you got a team of people that's supporting you right now. You know, this is when you want those people supporting you, is right now. And, you know, you bring your particular qualifications, but be real clear about what you want to continue doing. Okay, if you want to be the one who's instructing, then find someone else who start taking over, or some several people who will start taking over the more administrative duties, things that need to be done, the specific things. It's real easy to fall into doing it yourself. Trust me, I know from my own experience, but I also know how ineffective that is, and you're just asking for burnout. You just won't be able to continue doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
So you live in Eugene, right?
Yes, I live in Eugene. I've been in Oregon 6 years, so just learning my way around still, you know, and little things.
So Eugene is a big and vibrant community. And, and there's a therapeutic writing program there too, right?
Yes, it's not PATH, it's kind of shoot by your hip type. So,
I didn't know that. I heard about it a couple of years ago, but I haven't been back to Eugene. In some ways, something like that, I know you, so you're not going to be billing yourself as a therapeutic writing program, are you? Or are you?
No.
Because
it's assisted learning.
That'll help define you as separate to that in that program, which is actually probably important if they're not a PATH program. Some people may. I found this in San Antonio that it actually was a PATH program. This other program that was there. It was the only program in San Antonio at that time. Now there's several, but they weren't very professional. I discovered. And so they had created a prejudice against that kind of program in like the Junior League and a lot of places, actually, I found. I didn't actually fully realize it until I moved here and saw how much easier it was here. And I started analyzing, you know, why was that so hard in San Antonio to get supporters and money? And I realized that these people all had this experience with this other program, and I hadn't fully recognized the effect of that, and that I needed to. I should have attended to it more in a more focused way.
Right.
But anyway, you live and learn. So anyway, but you're starting off with a new focus, so that's great.
Right.
So, do you have a sense for how you could call together people just by networking in an informal way.
Yes. So I have I have a social worker and an occupational therapist, and then next week to meet with, and then 2 weeks from now, I have a clinical child psychiatrist to work with that are already interested in the program.
So what you want
to know about it. So I will meet with them.
No, you don't want to go and meet with them. No.
Okay.
We have a meeting where they all come together.
Okay.
That's what I'm trying to say. You've got to create this group, okay? Not just one-on-one. You have them, you find a time that hopefully they can all come, and tell them to bring others, okay?
Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Right. So you start engaging them all together as a group so that they know one another. And there's that group energy that you want. It's important that you start creating that.
That way they build up each other's energy. Yes.
Yeah. Right. So, the essence of that meeting is, okay, here's what I would like to offer the community. Do you think it's something we need? And you expect them to say yes, from what you already know, and then get their thoughts on how it would serve the needs of the community, and have a flip chart there so that you write down their responses for everybody to see. Okay, and then you look at, so that's like, you know, giving flesh to the vision that you have. And the specifics of where you can go from their wisdom, okay? And then you look at, you start brainstorming, okay, what do we need to do to get this going? And so you've already done a lot of this, okay? All the things you've been doing. You could have done this meeting much sooner, okay? And you could have some of them do some of these things you've already done, okay? But anyway,
okay.
The point, you've already created this foundation, okay, and you can lay out for them what you've done. But you want to get their wisdom on, okay, what else do we need to do? And you have input on that too, but they should have ideas about, you know, how to get the word out, you know, what else you need to do, who else needs to be there, like who isn't at the meeting today who really – would want to know about this and would get behind it, that kind of thing. You want to tap into the group wisdom about what needs to happen, and start empowering those people to take charge of whatever it is that they can take responsibility for. Now, there are some people who come to meetings like that and say, "Well, here's what you ought to do." Essentially, that's what they're saying. Here's what you ought to do. And so you want to, you know, politely flip that to, well, I appreciate your laying that out, but I want to make clear that it's got to be something that we are all participating in. So when you make a suggestion, I want to know how you can help with that suggestion, whether it's you taking, following through with it, or maybe finding somebody who can follow through with it. Okay.
Hey,
so
that's perfect.
This is Jen.
I wanted to just make a quick comment. Know what I think is really fascinating about the time that I've had in the group dynamics that we've been creating with Writing Beyond is that you're pretty open vessel as to where we're going to go. And being part of that co-creativity and trying to figure it out all together is kind of like being with the horses, right? We don't really have a strong force. We know kind of where we want to go, but we have all those people in the room, because I've been to a number of these meetings, and I kind of know what I want to do and what excites me. And when somebody else gets excited, then I want to figure out, oh, wow, what does that person have to give and what is that direction? And it becomes really fun. And that's when people, I feel like people jump on board.
So. Yeah, totally.
And then you don't have to do it all alone, Pat.
Okay. Sounds good.
You have no idea where you're going to go. It's very exciting. Yeah.
Yeah, there is that openness that is it is igniting of people's participation and enthusiasm. And yeah, it's if you're not used to leading a group and you feel like maybe you're not sure how to do that, find somebody else who could do it. Invite them particularly and say, you have to come because I need you to do this. I need you to lead the meeting. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something that I've learned over the years. It's definitely a learnable skill. But, you know, if you don't already know how to do that, then find somebody who does know how to do it. I'm sure there are people available there in Eugene. And you may already know somebody who's really great at leading meetings and
mm-hmm.
would be willing to help you get started with that. And, yeah. So, if you're interested, there's a circleswork.net. Lauren Oliver has developed a model, a technology model, if you will, for working in groups, for bringing people together in a circle, essentially, to work together. And if you go to her website, there's quite a bit of information there about it. How to structure a meeting in a way that is allows the leadership to be shared, and it also keeps a meeting from becoming just all business, and you know, allows it to go deeper.
Okay, and it's called Circle Work.
Circles, plural work.
Circles. Circle work.
CircleWork.net.
Okay. Next. Okay. Thanks.
CirclesWork.net, and see if that will give you some a framework that would be helpful to you. I'm happy to talk with you about it in more detail at another time, if you would like.
I would love it. Thank you.
Yeah. So. So I can't stress enough, you know, and I appreciate Jen bringing in the fact that it really is like working with horses, that you're working with the herd mentality of horses in this work, okay? That's one of the gifts of horses,
mm-hmm.
is their ability to be in a herd. So you've got to model it. You've got to be doing this as a human herd right from the beginning.
That's a good model to go on, especially as horse people. Yes.
Yeah. Mhm. And all the different roles of you know, of horse, of the herd. If you look at that PowerPoint from that I did in the last session about kickstarting your ideas into a broad-based mm-hmm. program, there's a list of different leadership styles, okay? And so in these meetings, you're looking for enlisting people to take on those different leadership roles, and for you as well, to take on different leadership roles that sometimes you're going to be up in front, but other times somebody else is going to be up in front of the room, so to speak, and to be willing to encourage people to step into the different leadership roles and to be flexible yourself in developing the ones that you're maybe not so good at. And so, you know, there's the leaders from, you know, who are beside you. There are leaders who are behind you. You know, there's a collaborative form. You know, just like, you know, in this call right now, I'm the one who's up front, okay? And I'd say Jen is there either at my side or behind me, you might say. But in other situations,
yes.
With people, friends I have, they're the ones who are up front, and I'm supporting them in different ways. I might not be right there at their side in the room, but I'm working from behind, say. But I might be at their side, you know, and it's a really I found that model to be very helpful in terms of validating other forms of leadership and the importance of them. So I'll check that out as you're thinking about how to have those kinds of meetings. Yeah.
Well, I've got a lot to think about. This is great. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Deborah, is there anything else that you'd like to ask about or say something
Well, the
about?
Only thing, you know, at some point it would be probably really cool to explore if we're going to keep doing these once a month meetings is, you know, how, because one of the first things people ask you when you say, I've got this great thing I'm going to do and, you know, had like money for this, and they go, what does it cost? Okay. How do you price something? How do you cost out something so that when you're talking to somebody who says, well, I want to donate money, but, you know, I kind of really want to know how you got to $150 a person per session or whatever your dollar number is. Because I know for grants you need to do that, or at least that's what I've been told. And then for, you know, when you approach a school or you approach a residential treatment facility or you approach somewhere and you say, hey, here's what I have to offer, and they're like, oh, man, that's awesome. Now, what's it going to cost me? And how do you justify the figure you're going to charge me? And I think that's part of the place where, you know, I'm not – I know it's going to be different in different areas because of different economies, but, at least having some ideas on, you know, past experience, you know, what are people looking at? What should I be able to justify to them? What should I be kind of pulling together as far as the pieces to say, here's how I price this program for you?
So, way to do that is that you, that would be another good topic. And so we can do that. But let me just give you the general rule of thumb about it, is that you basically add up all your expenses, okay?
Okay.
You look at the cost of taking care of the horses and how many horses there are and everything you can think of. And your budget, so you're making a budget, basically, for your first year, okay? And with the idea that it's going to change the next year because of, other things coming up. So you don't have to think that you're committing to 5 years in the future or something like that. But the other thing is to be generous, you know, like put in, $1,000 extra for unexpected expenses. But you put in insurance, you put in everything you can think of that costs to do business, right?
Okay.
And then, then you look at how many people you're intending to serve, and you just divide it up. Basically, you put in people's salaries, you put in everything, and then you divide it up. This is how many people I want to serve, and that's going to cost so much per person, and that's what it. And often it's several hundred dollars. Okay. And That's not what you're going to charge people, right? But that's the money that you have to raise somehow.
Okay.
And so you may get a grant, like you're getting this California grant, that where you wouldn't be charging them anything, right? Or would you?
But I'm assuming I'm going to have to justify – if they're going to give me the grant, I'm assuming I'm going to have to justify why I
exactly.
want so much money from the grant.
Yes, exactly. And so so the other thing is for you to do some research up front with the grant people. Your grant writer will know this, that you want to find out what the realm of possibility is, like what they're looking for, okay, what they tend to fund. Okay, you don't want to just do a shot in the dark. And so a good grant writer builds a personal relationship with at least one person in the funding, from the funding group. They talk to them about, this is what we're looking at. What do you think? They will tell you what kinds of things they fund and what the parameters are that they want to see. They'll tell you that. And it's important that you find those out. before you write the grant. And and so you write the grant with those things in mind. And that's the general thing, is that you add up all your expenses and then divide it up according to how many people you are planning to serve, and for how many weeks and so forth, you know, however you want to talk about it, and then what that comes out to. Now, you don't necessarily, you can, like this funding, this California State grant, they're not going to fund your entire program, but they're going to fund, because they're just going to, they're going to do EFP for 5 to 17-year-olds, but you're looking at other audiences, okay? So, you sort of carve out that piece of the pie that you're asking them to fund. You're asking them to fund this particular program where you're going to serve this many kids and, you know, how many hours and so forth, so that you're asking them to fund this percentage of your budget. You know, but you got to show them your whole budget. They want to see the whole thing, okay? Maybe you're going to they don't necessarily need to know what your other funding sources are going to be, but they often do want to see how you intend to get the funding handled. Like you're asking them for, you know, 20-25% of your budget, say. I'm just pulling that out of the air. It could be 5% or 10%, you know. And so they want to see what your plan is for bringing in the entire budget. Okay, so maybe you're planning to donate some of your own, like the cost of your horses or something for the first year to help things go. Well, you don't necessarily put it down that you're donating it, but you put in like in-kind services, okay? You talk about how you're going to maybe run a crowdfunding campaign, and that you intend to earn so many thousands of dollars with that, for that percentage of your budget, you see. So they want to see how you plan to meet this budget, okay? And it's for sure not going to work out that way because things never do exactly, but they want to see that you have a plan, okay? And then they very likely are going to want to see how it actually unfolded, especially the money that they gave you. They're going to want to see some accounting for what they gave you the money for. Okay?
Okay.
So those are kind of the broad parameters. It helps to sit down with someone who's done budgets before, like your CPA, for instance, who's on your board. And if these people have had nonprofit experience, they've done budgets, so you sit down with them. You definitely don't want to do it by yourself, but you need to give them the raw, your first hit at it, and then sit down with them, more than one person for sure, and get their input on the way you've configured the budget, and see what they have to say, because they should have some experienced opinions about it. So.
Okay, well, I'm on the right track because we've done some of that. We have done some of that. And for the last year, I went and pulled every dime I spent on horses for 2 years. So I have a 2-year history of expenditures.
Well,
feed, farrier, vet, supplements, you know, things they needed, you know, buckets or whatever, blankets or whatever they needed that was for their base care, not just for my fun. I threw in I've got that for, well, now I'll have it for 2.5 years since we're in July. So I do have a lot of that put together. And then I tried to go research, you know, what is an average kind of a cost that therapeutic riding instructors are being paid, so that I could kick that in. And I know what my insurance cost is. So it sounds like I'm at least on the right track of trying to break that all out.
Totally. Totally. Yep.
Okay.
Okay, well,
okay.
It's been a great conversation. We'll do this again in a month or thereabouts in August. And I'll look forward to it. And maybe we'll see what other topics need to come up. I am recording this call, so I'll put it on the Facebook page on the Writing Beyond.
Oh, good, good. Thank you.
And then others can look at it. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you all for attending, and look forward to talking with you again. And
yeah,
feel
thanks,
free to
Trish.
Contact me in between times. Thanks all for coming. Take care.
Okay.